Well, we're back tonight in 1 Samuel chapter 26. Last week, as we finished up, we read the story of Nabal and Abigail, David, how David was got himself all fuzzed up and was going to run down and slay Nabal and all of the men that worked for him. He was a big sheep herder, sheep farmer, and fortunately, he had a wife that was a lot smarter than he was, and she saved the day. And then Nabal, when he found out that his wife had given provisions to David and his clan, you want to remember his clan was 600 men. I don't know if they had very many women and kids with them or not, but that's pretty good table set every night for dinner. So when Nabal found out that Abigail had taken all the different food and wine and stuff that she did, he had a stroke and died after 10 days, remember? So then what was David to do except, well, I'll just marry Abigail then, and so helps her out and helps him out because now he has the access to the resources that she would have inherited with the sheep farm and feeding his people and all those kinds of things. And so all's well that ends well, I guess. And it turns out that she is his third wife now, if we're still counting Michal, but Saul gave her to another man after David left, but he still considers her his wife. So now he has Michal and Ahinoam and Abigail. And so they're starting to add up. So we come into chapter 26 today, and we get into the last portion of Saul's life here. And as David moves from here into the king, the end of this book, 1 Samuel, it ends with the death of Saul, chapter 31, I think. So we'll see how much progress we make tonight. Did you bring your little maps that I passed out last week?
I'm good.
I put mine in my Bible and then didn't bring my Bible.
I'm here. Yeah, I'm out. My table.
Well, Mike did.
I've got
You weren't here because you weren't here.
no, no,
I told him not to.
I didn't have my Bible. It's here.
So, chapter 26, then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding himself on the hill of Hakilah, which is on the east of Jeshimon?" So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. 3,000 men. You would think they could find something else to do in defending their country besides chase David around in the dobies. You'd think. I mean, just think about that. So you have this army. Who knows how big the army is? But he says, okay, you 3,000, grab your go bag because we're headed out. Well, how long? Well, I don't know how long. So how much stuff do you have to take with you to feed the troops? Because it's not like going to Saudi Arabia and the crown prince has a McDonald's truck waiting for you. Have you seen that?
Yeah.
That's great. Well, David doesn't have that. And so Saul calls these 3,000 guys out, and somebody has to go with them to cook biscuits and gravy or lamb, mutton, whatever they eat while
Abuse.
they're on the trail. So I mean, just think of the logistics involved in something like this. It's crazy. I always used to think about that when I would listen to stories of the Civil War, 100,000 people moving out to go here. And I thought, who's cooking for those guys? And what kind of logistics is involved in that? I never did get involved in studying the battles or anything. I just wondered about how do they move? What kind of food do they take when they don't have packaged food like we do? It's just like you can't go buy a sack of granola to take with you. You got to have a bunch of cows trailing behind. And who's got the water? Where did the water even come from? So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph with 3,000 chosen men of Israel to seek David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped on the hill of Hakilah, which is beside the road on the east side of Jeshimon. Of course, the first audience knows where all these places are. We could easily say the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah and say, instead of Ziphites, you could say the Cedar Ridgeites came to Saul at Echert and said, is not David hiding himself on Green Mountain, which is on the east side of, whatever? Then we could put ourselves in it because they would have known every little nook and cranny, the first audience that's reading this. We just have to guess. And, archaeologically, we have a lot of information like on that little map I gave you, but it's hard to track it all down. So he camped on the hill of Hakalah, which is beside the road on the east of Jeshimon. But David remained in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies and learned that Saul had indeed come. Then David rose and came to the place where Saul had encamped. So when Saul sets up his camp with 3,000 guys, David sneaks around in the wilderness and comes up relatively close. He came to the place where Saul had encamped, and David saw the place where Saul lay at night. So David's looking over and he can see. I mean, if you're looking at a wad of 3,000 people and they're all laying down to sleep and it's night, you have to be pretty close to see where Saul is sleeping. It's not like he has, 20 power binoculars that he can look from a mile away. They don't have that. So he is pretty close, maybe a little bit of an elevated hill if Saul is laying in the canyon there, whatever. But he's close enough to find out where Saul is laying down with Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Saul was lying within the encampment, which is natural because the troops, he would be in the center because that's the safest place, especially at night. And the troops on the perimeter would probably be the infantry, what we would call the infantry, the first line. And the first line of soldiers always had spears. And as they came back a few more ranks, they were usually carrying swords instead of spears. And the first line would have the spears that they go to. And then as they lay down in camp, of course, the king is in the center with his personal bodyguard, which in this case is Abner. Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army. Saul was lying within the encampment while the army was encamped around him. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Joab's brother Abishai, the son of Zeruiah. Zeruiah is David's sister, if you'll remember way back when we met the family. And so Joab, who is the leader of David's army, is his nephew. And he says, who will go down with me into the camp of Saul to Saul? And Abishai said, I will go down with you. So David and Abishai went to the army by night. And there lay Saul sleeping within the encampment with his spear stuck in the ground at his head. And that's probably not as much a piece of his weaponry as it is the staff indicating that he's the king. Now, it had a spear. It was a spear and could be used as a weapon. May have been the same one he kept throwing at David all the time when David was playing the harp. So it had a blunt tip because he always hit the wall. And here it's sticking in the ground. So, but notice that he made it all the way through the camp because he would have had to cross several lines of soldiers laying there sleeping in order to come up to Saul and Abner. Then Abishai said to David, God has given your enemy into your hand this day. Now, please let me pin him to the earth with one stroke of the spear, and I will not strike him twice. This is evidence of a true soldier. He's going to kill him with one strike of the spear and won't have to strike him twice. He's a professional soldier. He's an assassin here. And of course, he says, God has done this for you. But, like we've already seen David, as long as Saul is the king, David's not going to harm him. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who can put out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? And David said, as the Lord lives, the Lord will strike him, or his day will come to die, or he will go down into battle and perish. So we're coming right off the heels of David is charging down the mountain. He is going to go kill Nabal and all of the men that work for Nabal. And Abigail stops him and says, "You do not want this blood guilt on your hand, because when you become king, you don't want to look back and have this blood guilt." And David already spared Saul once, and now he's fresh off that memory of what Abigail told him. And he said, "The Lord will strike him, maybe like he did Nabal. Maybe the Lord will have Saul have a stroke and die or something, or he will go down into battle and perish. The Lord forbid that I should put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. But take now the spear that's at his head and the jar of water, and let's go." So David took the spear and the jar of water from Saul's head, and they went away. And no man saw it or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep because. And what does the word because mean? For the cause of a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. Here again, as I've said, in essentially every chapter of the Bible, certainly every page of the Bible, you cannot get away from the sovereignty of God. Whatever God's vantage point is, it's a long ways away, we think, from earth. But it's really not, because he's going before David into that encamp, and he's giving everybody, whatever it is takes him to sleep better, Benadryl, something. And God causes that whole camp of 3,000 men to sleep so sound that David and Abishai can sneak in there, walk all around them, step over a few of them here and a few of them there, probably trip on somebody's water jug and kick it over, have a little conversation there, grab the spear and a water jug, and then back out across all those soldiers.
Someone's got
In the dark.
Yeah. Huh?
In the dark.
In the dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, without headlamps. For they were all asleep because a deep sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. There is no way that a person that we call a deist in our religious circles today, a deist is one that believes, yes, God created the heavens and the universe, he wound it up like a watch and just lets it run. No, he is intimately involved in the lives of his children for their benefit, for their good. And so he caused the deep sleep to fall on all of these men so that David and his bodyguard, armor bearer, could go in there, pick up the spear and the water jug, and head back out. Then David went over to the other side and stood afar off on the top of the hill with a great space between them. Well, a great space would be a safe distance, but still close enough when he calls out, they can hear him. And of course, the Benadryl wears off, God causes them to hear him. David went over to the other side and stood afar off on the top of the hill with a great space between them. And David called to the army and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, "Will you not answer, Abner?" Then Abner answered, "Who are you who calls to the king?" And David said to Abner, "Are you not a man? Who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not kept watch over your lord the king? For one of the people came in to destroy the king, your lord. This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, you deserve to die because you've not kept watch over your lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the jar of water that was at his head. And really, he should be put to death for that, because that's his job, to protect the king. And when somebody sneaks into camp and takes the king's spear and water jug, the king's bodyguard dies." That's, pardon?
Except God stacked the deck on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Abner doesn't know that.
Well,
And neither does Saul. David does. Notice Abner didn't answer David. He's just probably thinking, ay, ay, ay. He's probably thinking he is going to get killed. Saul recognized David's voice and said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" Last time when Saul called out to David like that from the cave, "Is that you, my son David?" And he said, "Yes, my father." This time David says, "It is my voice, my Lord, O King." He doesn't recognize a friend relationship to Saul anymore. He doesn't call him my father, even though Saul is putting on, "Is that your voice, my son David? Why are you hiding? Why are you making it so hard for me to kill you?" And David said, "Why does my Lord pursue after his servant? For what have I done? What evil is on my hands? Now, therefore, let my Lord, the king, hear the words of his servant. If it is the Lord who has stirred you up against me, may he accept an offering. But if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day that I should have no share heritage in the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" Okay, let's unpack that just a little bit. David is giving Saul an out. David knows Saul wants to kill him because Samuel told Saul, "The kingdom has been taken from you and given to another." And Saul knows full well that the other is David. And Saul also knows that his son Jonathan, in some measure, has betrayed him. And Jonathan knows that David will be king. And David knows full well that it's not somebody else that is causing Saul to pursue, but David gives him an out. "If it's the Lord that set your heart against me, then let me make a sacrifice offering. If it's somebody else, but if it is men, may they be cursed before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day that I should have driven me out of the promised land." He's off of the border of Judah, outside the promised land. And so this is what he means. "They have driven me out that I should have no share in the heritage of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" So being outside of Judah, they were only permitted to offer sacrifices at the tabernacle. And he has no access to that. So in effect, he said, "These men that have whispered in your ear have cast me out from the heritage, the inheritance of the Lord, and are forcing me to serve other gods. So let them be cursed," is what he says. "Now, therefore, let not my blood fall to the earth away from the presence of the Lord, for the king of Israel has come out to seek a single flea like one who hunts a partridge in the mountains." So he's saying, "If you're going to kill me, at least let me come back into the promised land. I don't want my blood spilled out here among the pagans and the heathens. And why are you hunting me like a flea? I have a few men. Look at you. Just for a day's hike, you take 3,000 people with you to kill me." And he says to hunt like a partridge in the mountains. So let's put ourselves in their position. They don't have shotguns. David's pretty good with a sling. We already know that. But to hunt partridges in the mountains, you literally have to chase them until they're exhausted. And chasing birds is hard because when they want to fly, they can make some pretty good time away from you. And this is what David feels like. "You're hunting me like a partridge. You're chasing me around the mountains until I'm exhausted and can no longer defend myself. Why are you doing this?" is what he's saying. And then Saul said, "I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm because my life was precious in your eyes this day. Behold, I have acted foolishly and have made a great mistake." So this is a nice apology. Of course, it's nothing that David hasn't heard before. And David answered and said, "Here is the spear, O king. Let one of the young men come over and take it." How humiliating. I wonder if he actually did send somebody to get it. And wouldn't it be something if he sent Joab? Or not Abner, I mean. Yeah. let one of the young men come over and take it. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and faithfulness. For the Lord gave you into my hand today, and I would not put out my hand against the Lord's anointed. It's interesting. The word for anointed, of course, is Mashiach. So, you know, when we talk about the Messiah, we always think Jesus. But we have to remember that in the Hebrew, the term anointed one is anyone that has God's anointing on them for a particular task. And with Saul, he's the anointed king of Israel. So he is, at that moment, Messiah. Doesn't take anything away from Jesus when we use that word of him, because he's the ultimate Lord's anointed. But that's what this word is here. HaMashiach. Well, actually, this is with a B. BeMashiach. Behold, as your life was precious this day in my sight, so may my life be precious in the sight of the Lord. He doesn't entrust himself to Saul. He doesn't say, so my life might be precious in your sight. You know, I mean, respect what I've shown you by showing me this. He doesn't even go there, because he knows that Saul's not a man of his word, that he's crazy. He's insane with the jealousy of maintaining the kingdom, just like Herod was. And so he says, may my life be precious in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me out of all tribulation. And Saul understands the tribulation David's talking about is Saul. Saul is that tribulation. Then Saul said to David, blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them. So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. And that's the last account we have of Saul going after David. Yeah. Fred?
I was thinking the Philistines must have got wind of Saul's pursuit of David all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And because he tied in later, as we're gonna read about the Philistine Achish, probably what was going on between David and Saul was becoming pretty notable.
Well, at this point, David is actually in Philistine territory.
Yeah.
And he's been there before with Achish, the guy that you mentioned in the city of Gath.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so they do. And you want to remember when we, in the next chapter, when we talk about Achish, king of Gath, that's a city state. It's like Athens used to be a city state. Washington, D.C. is a city state. And so you would have the king of D.C. or the king of Denver or the king of Cedar Ridge. And so there were Pentapolis, of five big cities of the Philistines. Remember when we were first introduced to the Philistines, we mentioned there was five kings because they all had a city state. And in the area surrounding the city, we would call them suburbs maybe, then that king of the city state would have the right to dispense that property. And we're going to see how that works out in this next chapter. But it wasn't a king like what we talk about, the king of Spain or Great Britain or something like that. It's their city states. And that's how the early Greek environment was until Alexander went and conquered the whole world. But 500 BC, in the time of Socrates, and that they were city states. So Athens was a city state where actually Western civilization was pretty much founded there from them. But yeah, the Philistines are well aware of it. And they see that Saul is wasting a lot of time and expending a lot of effort and resources, you know?
Yeah, instead of chasing after them.
It's chasing David. Yeah. Yeah. So chapter 27, then David said in his heart, now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul, and we can put in parentheses, if I continue to stay within his range. Because David knows that he's been promised the kingdom. So he says, if I stay here and keep putting myself out as bait for Saul, he'll kill me one of these days. I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than I should escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand. So David arose and went over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, the son of Maoch, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath. Achish is the king. Remember when David went there once before, a few chapters ago, and all the men of Gath said, "Isn't this David who said they slew the 10,000s?" And so, you know, David began to fear for his life. So he pretended to be a madman and let his spittle drool down his beard and scratch the walls and things like that. So they didn't kill him, but he was able to escape that. This is the same guy, same city. The same city, remember, who their chief villain in that city was Goliath. This is the city that Goliath and his brothers are from. If we were going to go through Chronicles, it talks about at the end of David's reign, he gets in a fight and Goliath's brother is also killed by some of David's troops. You know, years after David killed Goliath. His name is Lammy, L-A-M-I, I think.
According to this map, do you have any kind of a time factor here? Because all of this routing around, chasing him around, how many years would you say?
The whole time that Saul chased David from the beginning, when David was first anointed, and he was, you know, in Saul's house at that time, getting the spear thrown at him, until he becomes king is roughly 13 to 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So verse 2, so David arose and went over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to Achish, son of Maoch, king of Gath. And David lived with Achish at Gath, he and his men, every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam and Jezreel, and Abigail of Carmel, Ahinoam of Jezreel, and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. And when it was told Saul that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought him. David spends 16 months here, a year and 4 months. Then David said to Achish, "If I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be given me in one of the country towns that I may dwell there." So Achish believes that David has fled Israel, deserted it. See, that doesn't trouble Achish because he doesn't understand that Israel has that land because of a covenant made to Abraham, you know, 1,000 years ago, roughly. From this time till Abraham, looking back, was almost 1,000 years. And so Achish has no God-given right to his property. He just takes it, the victor takes the property. And so it's easy for him to think, well, David is just fleeing Saul. He's betraying Saul, and he's come, and he's going to be like us. He's going to be with us. He doesn't understand the Jews' connection to their land and how it's by covenant. And neither does he understand the prophecy from Samuel to David that he's going to be the king of Israel. So when David comes over with his troops and he's now out of Israel, out of Judah, into Achish territory and asking, "Can you give us a place and we'll be here?" He automatically thinks, "I can use these guys as mercenaries." And David has a good reputation. He's a manslayer. So, you know, Achish is okay with that because he doesn't have the same worldview that David has of the land and the promise. So that's why it's so easy for Achish to say, yeah. Then David said, "Achish, if I have found favor in your eyes, let a place be given me in one of the country towns that I may dwell there. For why should your servant dwell in the..." He identifies himself as your servant to Achish. "Why should your servant dwell in the royal city with you?" In other words, he says, I'm a nobody. Yeah, I don't deserve to be in the royal city. Just give me, you know, someplace out there in the boondocks. So that day, Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore, Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. You can see that on your map. Ziklag is on your map there. And the number of the days that David lived in the country of the Philistines was a year and 4 months. So Achish had the right, because he was the king of a city state. He had the right to give that city, that area, to David. And Ziklag, for David was, this guy says, particularly suitable, this commentary. In the first place, it was a border town in the foothills between Philistine and Simeonite territory. Simeonite is the son of Judah, Simeon. And so when Joshua came in and divided up the land, then Ziklag is on the border between the area the Philistines control and the land that the tribe of Simeon had. And then I have some scriptures where that was taken by Joshua in Joshua chapter 19 and chapter 15. So now David and his men went up and made raids against the Geshurites, the Gersites, and the Amalekites, for these were the inhabitants of the land from of old, as far as Shur to the land of Egypt. Some of that property that he's talking about there in verse 8 is what we call the Gaza Strip.
Oh, wow. Oh.
It was a little bit longer portion then, because it says, you know, some of those tribes went down close to Egypt, but much of that property that they're talking about there is what we call the Gaza Strip.
That's really interesting.
So that's not really a new conflict there.
No.
And David would strike the land and would leave neither man nor woman alive, but would take away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, and the garments, and come back to Achish. When Achish asked, "Where have you made a raid today?" David would say, "Against the Negev of Judah." Negev is the southern desert. That's what that word actually means. It can be translated to the south. And usually it's desert portions out there. Against the southern part of Judah, or against the southern part of the Jeremielites, or against the southern part of the Kenites. And David would leave neither man nor woman alive to bring news to Gath, thinking, lest they should tell about us and say, "So David has done." And so he's really not telling Achish the truth here. He's letting Achish believe he's attacking portions of Israel and Judah, southern parts of Judah, when actually he's going out and he's wiping out other tribes, people who are friendly to the Philistines. And it sounds terrible, you know, it says he goes in there and he kills women, children, steals all the livestock and everything. But if you look a longer perspective, these are people he's going to have to deal with when he becomes king. So he's dealing with them now, before he becomes king.
Why are they bad people?
Well, God told Abraham, "This is all going to be your land, but it won't be yours until 400 years. Because the sin of the Amorites, and the Amorites is the general population, they can be called Amorites, you can call them Canaanites, because the sin of the Amorites has not reached its fullness yet. And when Joshua went in there, 400 years later, 430 years later, after the promise of God, when Joshua went in there, God said, "Take them all out. Men, women, children." Why? Because they are an abomination to me because of the way they worship and they sacrifice their kids. And if you don't take them out, then they will pollute you. 1 Corinthians 15:33 says, "Bad company corrupts good character." It's hardly ever at all that you send a few good people in with some bad people and all of a sudden everybody's good like the good people. That doesn't happen very often. You know, I get a kick out of some of these seeker-friendly churches that on Sunday morning they'll send four or five guys into the local bar down there. "We're evangelizing in the bar." The hell you are. They're evangelizing your men. That's what's going to happen, and it ordinarily does. And we had a pastor in Delta that was telling me about that, and I said, "Well, I'll believe you when next year that bar is closed and your church is prospering." And it didn't happen. Bad company corrupts good character. And so these people, when David becomes king, he's going to have to deal with them sooner or later, because he's going to have to rid the land of them. And God is going to stretch the borders of Israel under David, and again under Solomon. Under Solomon, it will encompass almost the entire area that God gave to Abraham. And those people will either have to be dead or subdued, really subdued. You don't give them a seat in Congress, like Ilhan Omar's seat. You don't do that. You don't invite those people to run the country. You subdue them or you kill them. This is what God told Joshua. And he said, when you establish a center right here, the people directly around you, you kill them all. And beyond that circle, you can subdue those people and make servants out of them. And beyond that circle, we'll deal with them later as your population grows. So David recognizes, when I'm king, I got to do something with these people. Might as well do it now. And he has the opportunity and he has the manpower. And so that's what he's doing. It took me a while to figure that out, because every time I read that, every year reading through it, I said, man, that's hard. Jimmy, that's just hard. You know, I mean, it's one thing to recognize that the men are soldiers, but it's another thing to recognize that the men and the wives and the children, from God's perspective, are just as dangerous as the men. As a matter of fact, this is where Israel got in some big trouble in Numbers chapter around about 22 with Balaam. And when he wanted to, you know, bring the prophet and prophesy the Midianites against, was it the Midianites? And the prophet went in and says, well, I can't prophesy against these. This is God's children. They're going to win. But then he went back and said, I'll tell you what you can do, though. You can't go up against them militarily. They'll defeat you. God said so. But what you can do is you can take your pretty young girls and send them out into their camp at night. Subdue those men. And that's what they did. And it didn't turn out good, either for them or for Israel. And so we read of the seven churches in Revelation about the sin of Balaam. So he has to deal with them at some point. Might as well be now.
And while this is all going on, David is winning over, because a lot of the people, the 600 men that he had,
yeah,
they're not, you know,
they're rascals.
They were ragtag outfit that kind of bonded themselves to David,
yeah,
under his leadership. And he's building a reputation as a leader constantly. And what he's doing here is part of that.
Well, it even just goes beyond that, Fred, because he's building that camaraderie, that soldier, you know, all for one among those men. But he tells Achish he's invading the regions of southern Judah, and he's not. These people are close enough to Judah, there's constant conflict. And so he's dealing with these people. So now the people of Judah, who know David, are seeing that he is actually their benefactor,
yeah,
as well, yeah, because now they don't have the conflict with these people. And so he's given some cohesion to the 600 guys. And then he's also, you know, showing the people in Judah, I'm on your team still. I might be living among the Philistines, but I'm on your team. And so it's really beneficial to him in a lot of ways. The only ones it's not beneficial to are the ones that are getting the sword. So such was his custom all the while he lived in the country of the Philistines, at the very end of verse 11-12. And Achish trusted David, thinking, he has made himself an utter stench to his people Israel, therefore he shall always be my servant. So David's plan is working. So in verse chapter 28, in those days the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, understand that you and your men are to go out with me in the army. David said to Achish, very well, you shall know what your servant can do. And Achish said to David, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life. Now David's in a tough place. Yeah, because Achish is expecting him to march with the Philistines against David's own people. And you could, you know, we have a section to deal with Samuel, but then it's going to come back and deal with David and Achish. But you can always refer to those words in Ephesians 2:4, when it talks about how bad things can really get. In verse 1, you were dead in your trespasses and sin and lived according to the world. Then down at verse 4 of Ephesians 2, but God. And you can just kind of pencil those in here. Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life. But God has a plan. Surprise, right? Now Samuel had died, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in Ramah, his own city. And Saul had put the mediums and the necromancers out of the land. Necromancers are like, we call them seance people. They try to contact the dead. Okay. And Saul put them all out of the land, because this is what Deuteronomy said he should do. Actually, it didn't say put them out of the land. It said kill them. And Saul put the mediums and the necromancers out of the land, and the Philistines assembled and came and camped at Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel, and they encamped at Gilboa. When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. Saul is getting close to 70 years old here. And that's not terrible, because that's how old I'm getting to be. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by Urim. The Urim is the stones in the robe that the high priest wears. And of course, he slaughtered the high priest, and the high priest's son took the robe and the Urim and Thummim, and now he's with David. And so God won't answer him. And part of the reason God won't answer him is because God already talked to him. He already said, I'm taking the kingdom from you. So what is God going to do? Change his mind? No. So he's not answering because there's nothing to answer. I've already told you how this ends. And it's, you know, sometimes I think this is an issue that we don't have to pray about, guys, because God already said it. You don't have to ask God if you can do this or that, because God is in his word. He's already said, no, you don't do that. So when God speaks once, you don't go petitioning thinking if I just keep asking, he might change his mind. Well, if he does, then he doesn't deserve to be God. God doesn't change his mind. He doesn't need to, because he's always right the first time. But the Lord didn't answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. Then Saul said to his servant, seek out for me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servant said to him, behold, there's a medium at Endor. Isn't this interesting? He's driven them all out of the land. They're all terrified. They're going to run away because they're all going to be killed. But as soon as he tells his servants, go find me a medium. I mean, it's not like they even leave the camp to go look. Somebody just stands up and says, we know where there's one at Endor. In other words, we're still using them. We know where the tarot card readers are. They knew right where she was. So Saul disguised himself and put on other garments and went, he and two men with him, and they came to the woman by night. And he said, divine for me by a spirit, and bring up for me whomever I shall name to you. So I'm going to change my channel over here. And divine for me a spirit, bring up whoever I tell you to. Verse 8. There was some good commentary on some of this, so I thought I might take the time to read this paragraph. Saul at last resorted to a celebrated medium at nearby Endor, who had somehow survived the purge. Disguising himself, Saul made his way at night to Endor in the valley of Jezreel, just north of Mount Moriah. After putting her at ease, Saul asked the medium to contact Samuel. After putting her at ease, because he said at the end of verse 8, divine for me a spirit and bring up whomever I shall name. The woman said, surely you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the necromancers from the land. Why then are you laying a trap for my life to bring about my death? But Saul swore to her by the Lord, as the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. Then the woman said, whom shall I bring up for you? He said, bring up Samuel. So I'm going to go back to the commentary. After putting her at ease, Saul asked the medium to contact Samuel, drawing on the demonic powers of necromancy. We should understand that they are demonic powers. She called up the apparition of Samuel. So startled was she by Samuel's appearance that she immediately realized that the work was of God and not herself, and that her disguised nocturnal visitor was actually King Saul. This implies that she did not really expect to raise up Samuel, but only a satanic imitation. She thought that she could, at least she would tell her customers, Yeah, no problem. I can bring Samuel up for you. But when the woman saw Samuel in verse 12, she cried out with a loud voice. And the woman said to Saul, "Why have you deceived me? You are Saul." The king said to her, "Do not be afraid. What do you see?" And the woman said to Saul, "I see a God coming up out of the earth." Saul didn't see it. Samuel, or the witch did, the woman of Endor. He said to her, "What is his appearance?" And she said, "An old man is coming up and he's wrapped in a robe." Saul would remember that robe because he tore it. Remember? And he's wrapped in a robe. And Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and paid homage. Then Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" Saul answered, "I'm in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams. Therefore, I have summoned you to tell me what to do." So after, I'm back at the commentary, after she described this vision as a spirit, that's an interesting word that she uses there. Let me, an old man is coming up with his appearance. She used the word, "I see a God coming up out of the earth," in verse 13, the word Elohim. Remember, most of the time we think of that as a, it just, it really in its essence means a mighty one. And then when it's used of God, it's the mighty one, the mightiest, and it's a divine one. But it, and just the root of it is a mighty one, as an old man clad in a robe. So this Samuel's appearance, even in visionary form, was not the expected result, clearly teaches that the necromancers or mediums have no real power over the deceased, especially the righteous, but can only produce counterfeits. So necromancers can call out to the dead, and the demons will play with them and even give them visions. I wouldn't even really necessarily call it a hallucination. I think it would qualify as a real vision, and the demon would make them believe that he is who they are actually trying to call up. When I first started reading this way back in the 70s, when I was started reading through the Bible every year, I just kind of wondered about this. What's really going on here? And then I started thinking, you know, this does not deny that witches can do that. They can. And they can play with the demons, but the demons play on them. It's not like they have a friendly relationship. The witch might think so, but the demon knows better. The demonic world is as filled with hate as God's kingdom is with love. They hate each other desperately.
Isn't that interesting? The Dems seem to hate everything about what's going on.
Yeah.
They're just hateful, you know.
So Samuel's appearance here is explained by the intervention of the Lord, who graciously permitted Saul one last encounter with the prophet. And remember, it does not appear anywhere in this text that Saul actually saw Samuel. He just talked to him. One last encounter with the prophet whom he had first sought so long ago in pursuit of his father's lost donkeys in chapter 9. So now we get to verse 16. And Samuel said, "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has turned from you and become your enemy? The Lord has done to you as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor, David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord and did not carry out his fierce wrath against Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. Moreover, the Lord will give Israel also with you into the hand of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons shall be with me." And that doesn't mean in the presence of God. That means in the grave.
Yeah.
Wow. Tomorrow.
You should have been satisfied with the Lord not answering him.
Yeah, we're like, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
if
never
you
mind.
Ask once and there's no answer, then stop. Yeah. Wow. Wow. "You and your sons shall be with me tomorrow. The Lord will give the army of Israel also into the hand of the Philistines." Then Saul fell at once full length on the ground. I bet he did. filled with fear because of the words of Samuel, and there was no strength in him, for he had eaten nothing all day and all night. Well, we already read it early part of this chapter. You know, he was terrified when he heard the Philistines were coming. So, you know, if you're the commander and you're the king and you're terrified and you think you don't have a chance because God's not answering, I mean, who has an appetite to eat? Right? Yeah. And the woman came to Saul, and when she saw that he was terrified, she said to him, "Behold, your servant has obeyed you. I have taken my life in my hand, and I have listened to what you have said to me. Now, therefore, you also obey your servant. Let me set a morsel of bread before you and eat, that you may have strength when you go on your way." He refused and said, "I will not eat." But his servants, together with the woman, urged him, and he listened to their words. So he arose from the earth and sat on the bed, took flour and kneaded it, and baked unleavened bread of it. And she put it before Saul and his servants, and they ate. Then they rose and went away that night. Or you could say went away into the night, just like Jesus when Judas went into the night. Think of the difference between that and the thief on the cross. "Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom." I mean, he saw the way that Jesus was dying. He heard Jesus say, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And he quit rebuking and making fun of and mocking, because he was initially. And then he turned and he said, "Man, something about this guy. They might have been right, those disciples of his." "Jesus, remember me when you come in your kingdom." He says, "This day, you'll be with me in paradise, buddy. Tomorrow, you'll be here with me in the grave, you and your sons. And the Philistines will also be handed over," or the Israel will also be handed over to the Philistines. Wow. What a scary chapter, huh?
I think it's interesting that comment about David that Saul or Samuel made.
Yeah.
That your neighbor David.
And has given it to your neighbor David.
Yeah. So all your fears were right. This guy's going to be king in your eyes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll stop there, and then we'll finish this book, God willing, next Wednesday night.
Oh, darn.
It's exciting. Well, it's time. We've got 1 minute left.
Darn.
Our Father God in heaven, how we thank you for this day, and thank you for your word. And thank you, Father, for the instruction it gives us in modeling our lives to learn how to respond to you and know when to petition and when not to, and see that the conflicts that are going on in the Gaza Strip today and in that holy land is not new. It's been going on ever since Ishmael was born, practically. And so I just thank you, Father, and help us to be good students and help us to be mindful of the way we live our lives so that we don't end up questioning you and being rebuked by you, as was Saul, but rather to live in the light of your holiness and your humility, as David did. Thank you, Father, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.